From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Samuel L. Jackson. He plays a former boxer living on the streets of Denver in the new movie Resurrecting the Champ. We'll talk with Jackson about the film and about his other roles, playing a Southern country blues man in Black Snake Moan, a philosophical hitman in Pulp Fiction, and a smooth-talking hustler in Jackie Brown. Also, music critic Milo Miles considers the celebrated salsa singer Hector Lavoe the subject of the new film El Cantante. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Our guest, Samuel L. Jackson, is one of Hollywood's most prolific and respected actors, known for a commanding voice, a dedicated work ethic, and a compelling screen presence. He perfected his craft in theater and TV and didn't get a leading role in films until he was in his 40s. Jackson's breakout role was as a friendly crack addict in Jungle Fever, one of four Spike Lee movies he's made. He's perhaps best known for his performance in Pulp Fiction, which earned him an Oscar nomination. Among his many other movies are Jurassic Park, Jackie Brown, Eve's Bayou, Shaft, and three Star Wars films. His recent films include 1408, Home of the Brave, and Black Snake Moan, where he plays a religious southern farmer who tries to reform the ways of a young nymphomaniac woman by holding her captive in his house. Now he's starring in the new film Resurrecting the Champ, based on a true story. Jackson plays a former boxer who's living on the street. He's discovered by a young journalist played by Josh Hartnett who wants to write his story. In this scene, Hartnett first comes upon the champ after he's been attacked by young thugs who wanted the thrill of taking down a pro fighter.
Old man, are you okay?
Yeah, boys is having fun, you know. It's fun to beat the champ.
You should get home.
No, I am home.
You say you're the champ? What are you talking about?
Yeah. Battling Bob Satterfield. Number three in the world.
Hey. How about, can I give you this?
Oh, yeah. Thanks. You done helped the champ when he was down and halfway out. I won't forget this.
You sure you're okay?
Yeah, about.
Okay.
I'm about 30% right now, but I'll be okay.
Well, Samuel Jackson, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's talk about your new film, Resurrecting the Champ. You play the title character. Describe your character to us, the champ.
He's a homeless guy who's an ex-heavyweight contender who lives by his wits and is pretty popular, I guess, or well-known in his homeless community as the champ. But he did have a lofty place in life in his mind or in the minds of some other people. And he's discovered by a reporter who wants to write a story about him and how he fell from that particular lofty place to this low place.
You know, one of your great assets as an actor is that voice. And I don't know how much of that's God-given and how much of it is your theater training, but it's missing in this role. I mean, it's a high, raspy voice you adopt. And we should mention that your character is based on a real guy. This was originally a story written by J.R. Moehringer in the L.A. Times magazine. Wonderful magazine piece about this guy, former boxer who was on the streets of L.A. Tell us how you developed this character.
I read the script. Usually when I read a script, I read it first and kind of see the character in my head or see some kind of skeletal outline of who I think he is physically. Then I give the script to my makeup artist and my hairdresser and ask them to do the same thing, and then we get together and kind of start talking about what we think he looks like. And my makeup artist, Al, has this computer program that he's put my face on, and as we talk about things, we can put different things on my face and kind of look at it and go, no, not that, and do this, and do certain things with it. So the physical creation is partly mine, partly Alan Pone's, partly Robert Louis Stevenson, who did the hair. And once we get the physicality down and called my dentist, Dr. Greco, and got those teeth made, and I saw him for the first time, it was kind of like, okay, now let me hear what he sounds like. Because oftentimes I never hear what a character sounds like until I speak as that character the first time in a rehearsal.
Right.
Or I'm on camera. Because I don't do lines out loud at home. I just kind of read them and learn them and go about my business. I don't know how that works, but it just kind of works for me. And once I looked at myself in the mirror and I started to move, I adopted that little shuffle that Champ has, which is my kind of tribute to him constantly being in shape and doing road work.
Right.
Even though he's an old guy, he has this little jog thing that he does.
Right.
And the voice that came out of me just happened to be, I guess, my grandfather's voice. You know, toward the end of his life, he was he suffered from a form of Alzheimer's. And when he talked to me, he had that high-pitched kind of raspy whisper that always made me lean very close to him and listen very carefully or ask him to repeat himself. And it just kind of became the thing that I used.
Did you learn boxing moves for this movie?
No, I did some boxing when I was a younger man, and I still remember it. And I watch boxing a lot, so I can mimic some things that still look pretty good.
I missed that in your bio. When did you box?
It's not in my bio. It's not part of, you know, it's not, you know, experienced boxer. Wow, when was that? I guess between college and New York, you know, okay. Coming up in.
So you trained, you know, a little and got into stuff. The ring sound, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what's fascinating about hearing you describe developing this is that after I'd seen the movie and read some of the production notes, I went back and looked at the original article written in 1997 about this real guy, the champ, and I looked at the actual description of the champ that J.R. Moeringer provides his readings, and it's really you. I mean, it's that guy on the screen. His voice is described as raspy. It looks like you.
Yeah, but it's not that voice. I've heard his, you know, tapes of that particular guy, and his voice is raspy like that.
Uh-huh.
More so than, like, man being up and like that.
Uh-huh. Okay. Strange. Are there any stereotypes or cliches about homeless people that you wanted to avoid?
Not necessarily. You know, interestingly enough, I've actually played another homeless guy in Caveman's Valentine, a guy named Romulus. But Romulus was a paranoid schizophrenic, and, you know, Champ is not. A paranoid schizophrenic. He's just a guy on the streets, or as he says, I'm not a bum, I'm just homeless. Interestingly enough, most of us have never actually met or had a conversation with a homeless person. I lived in New York for a lot of years, and, you know, we had a homeless person that lived in our neighborhood, and there were homeless people around the theater where I worked, and there were homeless people that I encountered on the trains or on the streets, and I ended up having conversations with more than my share of them. There are a lot of interesting stories about how those people got there, why they're there, and why they want to be there. And we've all, you know, read those strange stories about people who were very successful who ended up out there. Or, like, I don't know, maybe 9-10 years ago when I was in New York, they found this homeless woman dead in the subway one night. And then when they went through her stuff, they discovered, you know, she had like $75,000 in cash, and she had deeds to properties in Florida and, you know, Colorado and all these other places, bank accounts. And they found out she'd been a successful ad exec just, you know, 2 or 3 years before that and just dropped out. So we never know.
Well, the homeless guy that you're playing carries with him, you know, a proud boxing career, although it's many years in the past by the time we meet him. And one of the early scenes, some, you know, tough guys, young punks, decide they're going to go up and mess with him. And what's interesting to me about the way you, as the champ, react to these guys approaching him is that at times the champ is sort of this sort of weak and helpless guy who wants to be left alone. And then there are moments where he is sort of stirred to life and is willing to both show off his moves and, I don't know, he finds some pride in resisting these guys.
Well, not necessarily resisting them, but, you know, showing them that he did have those skills and he's not making up this story about who he is. And he does it with some proficiency. And it's not the first time these kids have come up on him and kind of bum fight him. He sort of knows what's going to happen. You can see on his face the first time they speak that he kind of knows, look, you know, I'm trying to eat right here, but now I'm going to be beaten up. And I'm not really going to fight back, because the less resistance I give, probably the quicker this will be over. And that's his thought. But he still has to do something that shows them he is the champ. So he does some really prodigious kind of boxing moves. He shows them a great jab. He shows them some good head movement. And he accidentally hits this kid too hard. And somebody's got to grab him, and the kid, you know, takes advantage of it.
If you're just joining me, we're speaking with actor Samuel L. Jackson. He's in a new film, Resurrecting the Champ. Well, I wanted to talk about another film, relatively recent one that you starred in, Black really? Snake Moan. Yeah. Craig Brewer film, who did Hustle and Flow. And I thought we'd listen to a cut here. I mean, in this, you play this man, this rural Southern guy, Lazarus, who encounters this young, I guess, nymphomaniac white girl, Ray, played by Christina Ricci. You find her after a bad night out. She's injured. You nurse her to health and then chain her in your house to try and reform her ways. And in the scene we're going to hear here, your character, Lazarus, is tending to her physical wounds, but also talking to her about how actually farmers rotate crops because change and renewal is important. Let's listen.
Now, I done seen it in nature, and I done seen it in me. You got to change and rotate the crop. Got to have change, else that seed won't take. Hell, girl, you got to cut that out. Laying up under all them fools, rutting on you like you're some bitch in heat, like you somebody's dog. A man or woman that enters into a union with Almighty God in the sanctity of marriage should not demean themselves by bending to another's will. Hell, girl, is you crazy? See, I ain't no saint. I ain't saying I ain't weak. I mean, playing guitar and them blood bucket jukes all your life, nigga, learn how to sin. And I do got sin in me. I ain't gonna lie about that, but I got respect. And all you got in you is bow. Just bow.
And that is Samuel L. Jackson from the film Black Snake Moan. Boy, that's a guy I'd listen to. You could get me to change my ways.
An interesting kind of place to start this conversation, yeah.
Well, you know, I know that you grew up around Chattanooga or in Chattanooga.
Yes.
Did you know people like this guy Lazarus when you were younger?
Sure, yeah. I spent my summers on a farm in Rome, Georgia, and my cousins and my uncles were very much like that, and all the guys that they knew were very much like that, that ran their farms and went to church on Sunday. They were hard-drinking, hard-smoking, hard-partying guys, but, you know, very righteous.
Right. And was it fun to be working in the South on this piece?
Oh, yeah. I totally loved being in Memphis at that time. It was so hot and sticky and muggy, and you can smell the food in the air and the people, you know, just kind of reinvent, you know, who I'd been, you know, growing up and invigorate me in another kind of way. I just kind of love being in the South a lot, you know, and I hadn't spent a lot of time there in a pretty good while. Maybe since I hadn't shot a movie down there since Eve's Bayou, pretty much.
Right, which is another great one, but goes back a few years.
Yeah.
You know, everybody who looks at this movie talks about kind of how rich and atmospheric it is and how strong the performances are. They're a little puzzled, at least, let me say, I was a little puzzled. Mm-hmm. We talked about this earlier, about how Christina Ricci's character, Ray, is transformed by this experience of being held captive. What is the power that this guy, Lazarus, brings to this relationship?
I don't know. It's probably the first time she's been treated as something other than an object by someone who didn't want anything from her, who really was trying to help her, who spoke to her like a human being, didn't touch her in a carnal way that made her understand that she was a worthwhile person without that, that there was a way to live and to not give in to every urge that you have. Sometimes part of being grown is not giving in. And I don't think she'd ever been given the opportunity to have that kind of experience.
To talk a little bit about working with Christina Ricci on this relationship was so kind of intimate and scary in some ways.
Wow. Well, she and I know each other very well because we have the same agent. So we see each other socially a lot. And she's such a dedicated actress. I mean, she gave so much to this part. I mean, that chain she was wearing was a very real chain. She had an opportunity to wear plastic, rubber, all kinds of things that would not affect her in that way or be that heavy. But she chose to wear a real chain so she could feel the weight of it, you know, the whole time we worked. She learned the vernacular. She ate fried bologna sandwiches. She immersed herself in this whole, you know, Southern Gothic kind of thing. And to perform and give yourself in, you know, just a small pair of white cotton panties and a cut-off T-shirt, three quarters of a movie, and not be self-conscious about it is a feat of bravery that I don't think a lot of young actresses could have pulled off. And thank goodness she trusted me enough to be in that particular space and let herself go. And I was able to get to all the places I needed to go because she was so willing to give of herself.
You know, you mentioned earlier that you have, I guess, a makeup person and a wardrobe person that kind of helps.
Well, makeup person and a hairdresser that helped me make decisions about how I want to look.
Right, and were they also involved in this? How did you
yes,
decide?
Yes, they were.
Yeah. So talk about giving us the physical, the look of Lazarus.
Craig also had something to do with this because he actually wanted me to look like a legendary blues man that we used several of his songs.
R.L. Burnside,
yes.
Great.
Lazarus looks a lot like R.L. Burnside. And the mutton chops and the hair was something that, you know, Craig kind of wanted, and we created the look and kept it, and then we, you know, had the gold teeth made, did that whole thing, and Al did the aging, you know, of the character so he would look older than I'd normally play. And once again, I was walking like some guys that I knew, being a farmer, a guy who was part of the earth and very earthy in his speech, his carriage, his understanding of people and their relationships.
Samuel L. Jackson's new film is Resurrecting the Champ. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Samuel L. Jackson. His new film is Resurrecting the Champ. When we left off, we were talking about his film Black Snake Moan. Now, the other thing that's great about this movie is we hear you sing the blues. Was that
well, you hear Lazarus sing the blues.
Okay, right. Your character
is very different from me singing the blues.
It is.
Huh? I can't sing. Yeah, I can't sing. I kind of gave myself to that particular character and let it happen. You know, it's kind of like you know, there are a lot of things. You know, strange things happen sometimes. I read the script, and I liked it. And once again, the script was, I think Craig was considering somebody else, and John Singleton sent it to me by mistake. But I read the script, and then Craig saw me on television talking about my life and realized, oh, wow, maybe he is the guy. And then he came and met me, and we talked. I went to the Academy Awards. One of the gifts in a gift basket that year was a Les Paul studio model Gibson guitar. And I got the job, so I had the guitar made. I was in New York promoting another film, and I went to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and I was standing backstage, and this voice came up behind me and said, you should play a blues musician in a movie and let me teach you to play guitar. And I turned around, and it was this woman, Felicia Collins, who plays guitar in David Letterman's band. And I laughed at her and said, yeah, right. And she gave me her number and everything. And I said, okay, if that ever happens, I'll call you. Boom, it happens. I call her. She becomes my guitar teacher while I'm in New York shooting Freedom Land. She teaches me all the rudimentary blues kind of chords, notes, and how to fret and finger and do stuff. And then that movie's over, and I go to do Snakes on a Plane. And the prop master on Snakes on a Plane happens to be a master guitarist. So he becomes my next guitar teacher all day long when I'm on set. When I'm not doing anything, he's in the trailer, you know, showing me stuff and teaching me the song. So
you're not making any of this up.
Back,
you're not making
no.
any of this up, are you?
No, not at all.
This
so by
amazing.
The time I got to Memphis, I could actually play. And I could actually play the songs, which kind of freaked out Scott Bomar, the musical director, and Craig too. So I was pretty much ready to go.
Wow, that is an amazing kind of set of fortuitous happenings. But you
yeah,
said
totally.
You said Samuel Jackson didn't sing, but Lazarus could sing?
Yeah, that well, character.
Yeah, so what happens if Samuel Jackson tries to sing?
It's not a good thing. You know, I have to be in a bathroom, and it has to be some echo from some sour walls and probably some steam.
Okay.
I never think of myself as a singer. I've done musicals when I was in college. I never had to do any when I was out of college, but I did musicals in college, and I was always like a, I always call myself, I guess, like an Ethel Merman singer. I get the lyrics out there, and I'm always on key. But that's the best I can do. I wouldn't call it singing.
Right.
More like song styling.
Can you, I'm not even sure how to ask this question, but I mean, I assume that you had to get in studios to record this music.
Yes, I did, yeah.
And so, so what happens, how do you get in a studio and become Lazarus and transform yourself into a blues singer? I mean, are you wearing all the costume stuff?
No, I actually recorded, I had a Tennessee jersey on.
Okay.
And I was in there kind of with, you know, Big Jack Johnson and all these guys, and I would, like, talk to them and hang out and learn a new lick, and they would look at me and go, wow, how'd you get to that place? And I kind of show them how I did it, and they would be kind of, wow, I never would have done it that way. And, okay, that's good. You know, so I was learning my own style, and I never thought of it as me. I always thought of it as something that Lazarus was doing or something he had to do, and I would pretend or act possessed and not consider, you know, Samuel L. Jackson in there doing it, but Lazarus.
All right. Well, having said that, we have to hear some of Lazarus singing from Black Snake Moan. Do you want to pick the cut?
I'd go with either Alice May or If I Was a Catfish. Deep blue sea. Oh, you big like my man running after me. If I Was a Catfish. Yeah, I think that's the name.
Let's hear it.
If I was a catfish, swimming along in the deep blue sea, I'd have all you big leg women fishing after me, fishing after me.
Samuel L. Jackson will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan, information at moma.org. And from the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Lo llamé, vengan conmigo. No me preguntaron dónde.
Coming up, Milo Miles tells us about the late celebrated salsa singer Hector Lavoe. He's the subject of the new film, El Cantante. And working with Quentin Tarantino, Spike Lee, and 300 Snakes. More of our conversation with Samuel L. Jackson. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. We're speaking with actor Samuel L. Jackson. He stars in the new film Resurrecting the Champ, which opens next week. He plays a former boxer who's living on the street. He's discovered by a young journalist played by Josh Hartnett, who wants to write his story. Jackson earned an Oscar nomination for his role in Pulp Fiction. His other films include Jackie Brown, Jurassic Park, Eve's Bayou, and Shaft. Well, everybody knows your famous lines from Pulp Fiction. I mean, they're icons of cinema. But, you know, I really love
you know, the other one of the other Quentin Tarantino films you did, Jackie Brown, which is just has such a terrific cast and a great
awesome movie.
Yeah, and a great role for you. You want to describe your character, Odell Roby?
Odell Roby?
Yeah.
Odell is hustler of sorts. You know, he would call himself a gun dealer when you meet him in this particular film, but he's, you know, more or less a hustler who lived on the streets, lived by his wits his whole life, done some time in prison, who is a very affable and funny kind of guy, but extremely dangerous.
Well, let's listen to a scene. This is early in the film, and you are Odell Roby, and one of your guys has gotten arrested, and you're talking to the bail bondsman, Max Cherry, who's played by Robert Forster.
All right, you want a $10,000 bond? What have you got to put up for collateral? Gonna have to use cash. Do you have it with you?
Got it right here in my Raptor bag.
You have cash. What do you need me for?
Come on, man. You know how they do. Black man show up with 10,000 cash. First thing they want to know is where I got it. Then they gonna want to keep a big chunk of it. Start talking that court call. That noise, Jack. I go through you.
Cost you $1,000 for the bond.
I can do that.
Who's it for? Relative?
Fella named Beaumont, they got him down in county. Started out drunk driving, but they wrote it up as possession of a concealed weapon. Dumb monkey had a pistol on him.
$10,000 sounds high.
A-Run, his name, got a hit. He been inside. Plus, he from Kentucky, and I think they kind of prejudice against brothers from down south out here.
If he runs and I have to go to Kentucky to bring him back, you pay the expenses.
You think you can do that?
I've done it.
And that's Robert Forster and my guest Samuel L. Jackson from Jackie Brown. Fun to hear that stuff. It's been a few years.
Yeah. Well, I was actually thinking about the first part of that scene because the first thing I say to him is, I didn't hear you wash your hands because he's in the bathroom.
He's coming out of the bathroom, right?
Yeah.
And, of course, he ignores us and says, what can I do for you, my friend, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that dialogue and a lot of the memorable stuff from Pulp Fiction, when I hear you in these roles and quite a few others, I think you know, you're one of these actors that and I mean this as a compliment, doesn't look like he's acting. I mean, you just make it look so easy. How hard do you have to work on scripts and scenes to get it the way you want it?
There are a lot of things that you know, go into characterization, hearing the words, hearing the relationship between that character and the character that he's talking to and the kind of impression that he wants to make on him. I guess I was fortunate because I had a lot of good directors in the theater that posed the right questions that made me seek the answers in a specific kind of way. Where are you coming from? Where are you going? What are you trying to accomplish in this particular moment? What do you want to accomplish, you know, 20 pages from now by doing something here? Or does this relate to that at all? And those kind of things help me decide how I want to be in a particular moment. And one of the people I used to watch a lot when I was a young actor in the theater was Morgan. You know, I actually was fortunate enough to be in a
Morgan Freeman.
Plays that, to be in a couple of plays that he was in, and then to actually go and watch him work on stage and watch the ease with which he did things, and say to myself, "Wow, now I know this guy really well, but I'm sitting here watching this play, and that's definitely not the guy I know." And I always wanted it to be that easy for me or to be that convincing for people that watched me or that had seen me in something else. So I'm constantly striving from film to film to help people forget it's that guy who was in Pulp Fiction or that guy who was in SWAT or the guy from Negotiator, but it's that particular character who's in that particular story that's captivating them for that moment.
There's a rhythm to a lot of this dialogue. Do you mark up your script at all and kind of help you decide what you're going to punch, how you're going to deliver it?
Well, I don't underline words. No, I don't do that. Yeah. I do mark my script up, and I write things in the margin sometimes about where I was coming from, like I said, or what I'm trying to accomplish in this particular scene, or do I want the character to trust me, not trust me here, or to be afraid, to be intimidated, not be intimidated, to help me, not help me, to understand me, or, you know, just little things for myself.
How did your partnership with Quentin Tarantino develop?
I don't know. You know, it's kind of strange. I do remember auditioning for Reservoir Dogs in New York on a Sunday. And I was supposed to read with Harvey Keitel and Tim Roth. And I got there, and neither one of those guys were there. And I ended up reading with Quentin and Lawrence Bender, not really knowing who those guys were. But I did know that they were awful when I was doing the audition. I was like, damn, there's no way I can get this job because these guys are horrible. So I was kind of bummed out. And I went on to do something. And I went to Sundance that year with another film. And they were screening Reservoir Dogs. And I went to the first screening, and I watched it. And I watched people run out of the theater and run up the aisles. And when the movie was over, I went up to Quentin and said, hey, man, you know, this was a really good movie. And he looked at me and said, oh, wow, how'd you like the guy who got your part? And I was like, oh, you remember me. Well, it would have been a better movie with me in it. And he said, no. I'm actually writing something for you right now. I was like, you remember me? He was like, yeah. And I just figured it was another, you know, typical Hollywood line to get me out of his face and going about your business. And I went off to do a film about some cadets at West Point where I played a lawyer defending a cadet at West Point. And while I was there, the script for Pulp Fiction came.
So he was writing he was writing that character, Jules Winfield, for you?
That's what he said.
Right. But then I heard you end up having to audition for it. Is that right?
That happened later. I was doing Fresh, and right before I left to go to New York to do Fresh, they called me in so that they could hear what Jules sounded like. And I got there, they gave me a script, and I just kind of went through it, you know, read the lines. I hadn't had time to do any of the things that I would normally do, but I, you know, sat down, read it kind of cold, went through it with them, and they were like, great, oh, out of sight. And I went off to do Fresh. So while I'm there, they started to audition actors for the movie, and this one actor came in and said, you know, the part they wanted to audition for didn't really have a lot of lines. So he said, do you mind if I read some of these lines from Jules? And they were like, yeah, cool. And he did, and all of a sudden they were like, oh, my God, this guy's fantastic. He's amazing. So I start hearing rumbles about, well, maybe you won't be doing this part. And I'm like, wait now. Nobody told me when I came in there to read that day that I was auditioning. They just said they wanted to hear it. So my agents got involved, and they started, you know, fussing at people, and they jumped on Harvey and Bob. And Harvey said to them, okay, you have to give Sam a chance as an audition. You can't just get this other guy to roll. So here we are once again. I'm in New York. I got to get on a plane after I finish shooting on a Saturday, you know, go through the script, break it down, do all the stuff that I normally do on the plane on my way to L.A., and I get there Sunday morning, and nobody's there. Everybody's gone. They gone to lunch or whatever, and they come back in and go, hey, Sam, good to see you, da-da-da-da. And this one guy who was working on the film, they were about to introduce me to him, and he goes, oh, no, you don't need to introduce me to this man. I love your work, Mr. Fishburne. I'm like, what?
No, really?
Yeah, so it's kind of like, oh, here we go. All right, so we get in the room. They got this kid. They hired this kid to read with me. I'm not reading with Quentin Lawrence this time. They hired an actor to read with me. I started doing the scenes with him. The first scene that John and I have where we're in the car, I started doing the scene with him. And this kid gets lost in the script. I mean, I'm like, dude, read the script. Look at the page. You don't have to look at me. And then I realized, you know, I'm like rocking it so hard. You know, he's like fascinated by what I'm doing. And everybody's quiet, you know, they're in the room just tripping, and we kind of go through the rest of the script, and we do the killing room, and then we get to the diner. And
this is the last scene in Pulp Fiction where you have that confrontation in the diner. You're having this moment of revelation,
Right, so by the time I do the last speech in the diner, it was crazy. So they would just totally, I mean, a pin drop there in the room, and everybody would have sounded like an explosion. And that was kind of it. And, you know, Lawrence Bender looked at me and was like, wow, man, we never really knew how this movie was supposed to end until we heard you read this speech. And I'm like, okay, does that mean I had a job? And I'm like, oh, yeah.
Well, I mean, I think that final scene talk about a memorable moment in American cinema.
Yeah, it's great, too, because interestingly enough, that's the first stuff we shot in the movie.
The final scene in the diner, huh?
Yeah, the diner was the first thing we shot, and then I didn't work again for like 2 months because they had to shoot Bruce out because he had to go and do 12 Monkeys, and they had to shoot Uma out because she was doing something.
Uma Thurman and Bruce Willis, yeah. Right.
And then they got back to me and John.
All right, well, maybe we should hear a little bit of that final scene from Pulp Fiction.
You read the Bible, Ringo?
Not regularly, no.
Well, there's this passage I got memorized. Ezekiel 25:17. The path of the righteous man is beset on all sides by the iniquities of the selfish and the tyranny of evil men. Blessed is he who in the name of charity and goodwill shepherds the weak through the valley of darkness, for he is truly his brother's keeper and the finder of lost children. And I will strike down upon thee with great vengeance and furious anger those who attempt to poison and destroy my brothers. And you will know I am the Lord when I lay my vengeance upon you. I've been saying that for years. And if you heard it, that meant your ass. I never gave much thought to what it meant. I just thought it was some cold-blooded to say to a before I popped a cap in his ass. But I saw some this morning made me think twice. See, now I'm thinking, maybe it means you're the evil man and I'm the righteous man. And Mr. 9mm here, he's the shepherd protecting my righteous ass in the valley of darkness. Or it could mean you're the righteous man and I'm the shepherd. And it's the world that's evil and selfish. Now, I'd like that. But that ain't the truth. The truth is, you're the weak. And I'm the tyranny of evil men. But I'm trying, Ringo. I'm trying real hard to be the shepherd.
That's Samuel L. Jackson with Tim Roth in a scene from Pulp Fiction. Jackson's new film is called Resurrecting the Champ. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Samuel L. Jackson. His new film is Resurrecting the Champ. Well, I thought we couldn't go through this interview without reliving this important moment in your career.
We gotta clear the snakes out of the cockpit.
Yeah, clear the snakes out of the cockpit, yeah.
Enough is enough! I have had it with these snakes on this plane! Everybody strap in! I'm about to open some windows.
Now, what movie was that?
snakes on a plane.
Yeah, that
maybe.
Was it. I'd heard that line that you know I'm tired of these blankety blank snakes on the plane was added afterward because there was so much internet buzz about the movie in production that people wanted you to hear that line.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah,
but I wanted to say it while we were shooting, but nobody listened to me. I was like, well, just shoot it anyway. And it's like you know, and I'm. A hardcore believer in it's better to have something and not need it than need it and not have it because then you got to spend more money to come back. Now we were standing right there. All you had to do is shoot it.
And people were aware that this line had sort of popped up on the internet. And so you said,
yeah.
Hey, what do we got to lose?
Course.
Let's do it. And then they decided they wanted it.
All I could say was, I told you so.
that and I'm going to open some windows.
Yeah.
So did you work with real snakes in this thing?
There were about 300 real snakes on set, and by the time we finished, there were five.
what happened to the other 295?
No, 500.
Oh, 500.
Yeah, they were interacting at night while we were, you know, at home.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so they were doing some mating around there. There was a bunch of snakes.
Wow.
But we very seldom had to come in contact with real snakes, and my agents were not so happy about the fact that they had that many real snakes around, so they had this little clause where snakes had to be like 25 feet away from me. But we didn't have any poisonous snakes on our set. We had poisonous snakes on the second unit, but not with us.
We're speaking with actor Samuel L. Jackson. His new film is Resurrecting the Champ. You know, I know a long ago, early in your career, you struggled with alcohol and drugs, and then you did that very memorable role as the crack addict in Jungle Fever.
Gator.
Right. Were you drawing on that experience when you were doing that? I mean, had you actually done crack yourself?
I was out of rehab, I think, well, maybe 2 weeks. I really didn't even need makeup when we were doing Jungle Fever. I was still detoxing.
Wow.
Yeah, I was kind of fresh out of rehab when we did it, and the people in rehab swore I was going to be back. Saying, yeah, you do that movie, you're going to be handling pipes and lighters, and all your triggers are going to kick in. You're going to be using. You'll be right back here. And I was like, you know what? If for no other reason than I don't want to see any of you in life again, I won't be back.
Okay.
Well, so I survived that, you know. But, yeah, interestingly enough, you know, there's a lot of stuff that happens when you use, and generally when people play addicts on screen, they're so busy playing the effects of being addicted or high or whatever that they forget the fact that it's about people and relationships. And that's what I wanted to play.
The part. You mean, Gator's, yeah, right.
Gator's manipulation. The likability of a crackhead, not the danger and the, ooh, he looks like he stinks. But, you know, he's a funny guy. He was very affable, and people, you know, saw him. They laughed at his jokes. He had that little dance that he did for his mom. He was a master manipulator. And I kind of did a lot of that when I was using. I used people. I got money from them. I owed everybody by the time I went to rehab. And it was just one of those kind of things that allowed me to get rid of a whole bunch of demons. And by the time they actually killed him on screen, I was kind of cured of my, you know, need of wanting to do all that stuff and getting rid of that particular phase of my life and moving on.
Well, why do you think you did succeed in staying clean when so many people have relapses?
Because I had this very palpable difference between who I was and who I became. When I got clean and I did Jungle Fever, all of a sudden I was going to lunch in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And before that I wasn't. So it was a very real kind of difference to me that when I was using and I was doing that stuff in New York, I wasn't getting the jobs that I wanted. As soon as I stopped, I started getting all these opportunities and creating spaces for myself that I wasn't able to create before. So I knew that if I was doing this, I was doing the right thing, that I had finally found the secret, get out of my own way. And that's what I did. And I figured that if I picked up a drug or a drink, I would end up back in that place where I was before, where I owed everybody money and all my, you know, bill collectors were chasing me. And all of a sudden, I wasn't in that place anymore. So I was kind of like, oh, this is not so bad.
Right. I mean, the before and after.
I can go with this for a while. I can try this.
Before and after picture was real clear.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yet, I mean, a lot of people then.
And for a lot of people, it's not, because they're already there. They're already in this lofty place, which allows them to, you know, go to clubs and have access to drugs and have access to cars and do all this stuff. I didn't have that before. I was just using drugs. I didn't have access to clubs. I didn't have access to hot chicks. I didn't have access to hot cars and, you know, people buying me clothes or telling me how great I was. I was just, you know, a guy doing plays, getting high.
Okay, well, Samuel L. Jackson, I wish we had more time, but I want to thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Samuel L. Jackson, his new film, Resurrecting the Champ, will be in theaters next week. Coming up, Milo Miles on legendary salsa singer Hector Lavoe. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. The new film El Cantante tells the story of Hector Lavoe, the most celebrated salsa singer of his generation. He came to New York from Puerto Rico when he was 17, and 4 years later, in 1967, began singing with Willie Colon's orchestra and immediately scored hits. But Lavoe was constantly troubled. He was tormented by heroin addiction, the death of his son, and bouts of depression. A suicide attempt in 1988 all but ended his career, and he died a pauper in 1993. Music critic Milo Miles has these thoughts on the man, the music, and the movie.
Tiene su final. Nada dura para siempre. Tenemos que recordar que no existe eternidad. Como el lindo clavel.
If you have to ask whether you should see El Cantante, you probably shouldn't. For those not already committed to the music or the stars of the film, it's a very unsurprising rehash of the cliché, brilliant musician destroyed by stupid drug tricks. And it's careless. The flavors of the 60s, 70s, and 80s are glossed over. Most of the characters are stick figures. People appear 20 years earlier or later and look the same age. El Cantante does accomplish the basic requirement. The music hits hard and vibrant, conveying a reeling excitement of the good times for Fania Records and Salsa. A lot of the credit goes to Mark Anthony as Hector Lavoe. He's at least as strong a vocalist as Lavoe was, and of course excels as a dynamic stage performer. It's his night job, after all. And he channels Lavoe, doing an admirable recreation of the venerated singer's Latin soul style. You have to be a huge fan of Anthony's real-life and in-the-movie wife, Jennifer Lopez, to fully enjoy the tale, however. It seems like she's on screen every 10 seconds, and who's going to tell a producer to limit her role? You get the impression that Lavoe's wife, Nilda Rosado, known as Pucci, was as important and famous as he was. But until El Cantante, I'd barely heard of her. Here Lavoe sings about his many sorrows. If you avoid the film, try to pick up on its buzz about salsa, which mixed Cuba and Puerto Rico, rock and soul, boogaloo and Latin pride. From the late 60s until the middle 80s, Fania Records was the Motown of salsa, and Lavoe singing with trombonist and bandleader Willie Colon was as key to the image and success of their record label as Smokey Robinson and Marvin Gaye were to theirs. For Colon, the bad boy persona was more or less an act. For Lavoe, sadly, it was not. You sense from both El Cantante and his semi-autobiographical songs that keeping his life a roller coaster of terror, tragedy, and exaltation was good for the material. Here is Mark Anthony's version of the tormented title song.
Yo soy el cantante que hoy han venido a escuchar lo mejor del repertorio. A ustedes voy a brindar y canto a la vida de risas y penas, de momentos malos y de cosas buenas.
The best tribute to Hector Lavoe is to get more familiar with the music of the players featured in El Cantante. Lavoe has a superb double disc best of called Lavoe's. Mark Anthony's greatest hits package is called From the Beginning. Those who want only a single disc overview of Lavoe can try the well chosen El Cantante, The Originals. And salsa fans in general may want to do a compare and contrast with that album and the Mark Anthony El Cantante soundtrack. But why does the soundtrack end with a previously unreleased J-Lo song?
Music critic Milo Miles lives in Boston. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillug, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menhebar. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Somerset Maugham's novel Of Human Bondage, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Bill & Melinda Gates Foundation, working to ensure that more students graduate from high school ready for college, work, and citizenship, gatesfoundation.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Eugene Hoots, the star of the movie Everything is Illuminated, is also the leader of the gypsy punk band Gogol Bordello. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
I know you since you were a 20. I was 20 and thought that some years from now